Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A year ago, we decided that one of our election year initiatives was going to be called Protect the Vote. Now, little did we know we'd have so much content for these segments this year. This election year, voting, not the political horse race or the tight Senate races, voting has made headlines like never before, from postponing state primaries because of the pandemic, to dozens of state court decisions, to congressional hearings prompted by concerns about the U.S. Postal Service's ability to deliver millions of absentee ballots on time, to a shortage of poll workers. The process of holding free, fair elections has been in the spotlight in 2020. But as we learn in the new film, All In, The Fight for Democracy, the fight to expand voting rights and to ensure that everyone's vote is counted is as old as the country itself. The film uses contemporary examples like Stacey Abrams' 2018 race for governor in Georgia to show how pervasive voter suppression has been for decades, the different tactics that have been used over the centuries to keep people from voting, and the people who are making it tough to vote aren't going anywhere. You can watch All In, The Fight for Democracy on Amazon Prime. And to mark National Voter Registration Day, the film will be for free on Prime. You can watch the film on Twitch, Twitter, or YouTube as well. Join me now, our directors, Liz Garbus. Hi, Liz. Welcome back.
Hi, Allison. How are you?
Doing great. And Lisa Cortez, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, how are you, Allison?
I'm doing great. It's just interesting. I've had you both on the show in the past 3 months talk about completely different projects. Liz, your project about the Golden State Killer, and Liz and Lisa, your documentary about hip hop fashion. I'm curious, Liz, how did you and Lisa end up working together on this?
We came together over a year ago. Stacey Abrams had approached me and my company about making this film about not about her race. But about the fight for the vote, which, as you mentioned in your intro, is a centuries-long battle. And I knew Lisa through her work on the Apollo Theater documentary that my husband Dan Kogan was an executive producer on that just won an Emmy. Yay, Lisa! And together at that time to, we had a lot of work to do. We did not have a ton of time to get it done, and to kind of join forces to make this film together.
Now, this film could have just been about the past 2 years, but you have, it's interesting, the span of it, because you have footage of lines from the Georgia primary, which was held in June. However, it's a very deep dive into the history of voter suppression. Lisa, why and when did you decide to balance the present and the past?
Well, it truly, we've seen that the past is prologue to this present moment. Mm-hmm. I think all of us are trying to figure out, how did we arrive at this place? And when you look at the history of voter suppression from the inception of our country to its different manifestations, you understand the through line of that power play.
And I want our audience to hear what I'm talking about. One of the things the film captures is this cycle of expansion and contraction of voting rights. Here's a clip from Emory professor Carol Anderson about what's actually written in the Constitution when it comes to who can vote.
You won't find sitting anywhere in the Articles of the Constitution where it says American citizens have the right to vote. When you have the founders writing in the language of enlightenment, dealing with getting rid of monarchy and getting rid of kings and having this wonderful, beautiful republic, and then you have 6% who are eligible to vote, white male property owners. It tells you we had a lot of work to do.
That clip is from All In, The Fight for Democracy. I'm speaking with its directors, Liz Garbus and Lisa Cortez. So, Liz, we hear from Carol Anderson throughout the film. We also hear from Eric Foner and Ari Berman. How did you decide who you wanted to be your experts slash kind of witnesses?
Stacey Abrams is a producer on the film. We worked closely with Stacey to explore, not just great speakers like, Professor Anderson, but also scholars. All those that you mentioned fit that bill. And, just the clip that you just played, it's in the context of the first election. you know, for George Washington, that only 6% of American citizens were actually had access to the ballot box at that time. And so we talk about the voter suppression. It's not even about voter suppression. It's actually just about how narrow the franchise was and the centuries-long struggle to expand that franchise to all citizens.
Lisa, historian Eric Foner points out that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which were ratified after the Civil War, that those amendments made the Constitution a vehicle for claiming equality for the first time. So why was that a significant shift?
Well, you know, when we look at the in where we start, you know, initially African Americans are deemed to be three-fifths of a person. So certainly with these subsequent amendments, we're seeing the recognition of the African American, well, first of all, citizenship, and then African American men. In terms of their right to be able to vote. But we know that it certainly doesn't, we have to wait until the 19th Amendment for white women to be able to vote. And we really don't see the residual effect of this movement until the Civil Rights Act of 1965, where black women and other people of color are fully able to engage in the franchise.
The Voting Rights Act, no, Civil Rights Act.
Sorry, Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, that's all good.
So there's a point in the film where you talk about the states of California and Oregon delaying ratifying the 15th Amendment. Could you explain what that was about, Liz?
Sure. I mean, I think what we've seen, and it's sort of what Lisa was building towards, is, you know, at every moment that there is an expansion of the franchise, like we look at the Reconstruction Amendments that you guys were just talking about, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, we see for the first time African-American senators going to African-American representatives going to the to Congress and being elected as senators and governors, you know, these high offices just 10 years after the slaves are freed. And all of a sudden, you know, white America is like, wait, we didn't really mean that we wanted to share power. And you see this retrenchment. And it's that cycle of expansion and retrenchment which has character, which characterizes this story. So I think about it as sort of a horror movie in which, you know, every time you think you've slayed that dragon, it shows up again with another face. California and Oregon, you know, they were not so concerned about necessarily, you know, freed blacks having the right to vote. But, you know, in their communities, they were frightened of Asian Americans. So it's anything that challenges the status quo, that challenges power, that then triggers these retrenchments that are in the form of voter intimidation or violence, you know, which we of course saw with KKK terror all across the South, or laws like literacy tests and poll taxes, et cetera. And then those come back in their modern forms. And, you know, for instance, in Georgia in 2018, in a way that I'm sure we'll talk about it in this conversation.
Yeah, it's just so interesting because it was Reconstruction and then the redemption. It's like, oh no, it worked. People voted. This is what happens. Uh-oh. People actually voted. I want to talk about the Mississippi Plan of 1890. Lisa, can you explain what that entailed?
Well,
and how it spread to the other southern states?
With this expansion and contraction, what you see post-Civil War is this great promise where we have black senators and governors being elected. And then the Mississippi Plan is actually legislation, which was passed to disenfranchise, to disarm, to create these barriers. It starts the introduction of poll taxes, literacy tests, and all of these restrictive measures that obstructed the access to the vote for the black folks of not only starts in Mississippi, but then it turns into the black codes that extends throughout the South.
And Liz, you know, there's something I think is a very moving scenario act in the documentary, because it really points to the fact that it was dangerous to even try to vote. The story of Maceo Snipes, a black man who wanted to vote in the 1940s. First of all, why did he want to vote so much, and what happened to him as the result of him wanting to vote?
Yeah, so Maceo Snipes was a World War II veteran returning to Georgia. And he, there was an election in that year, I believe it was 1946, and Eugene Talmadge was on the ballot. And Eugene Talmadge was running on a white supremacist platform, you know, overtly. And Maceo Snipes got back, had fought fascists, lived to come home and tell the tale, thought, you know, I'm going to exercise my voice in this democracy here at home. Went to the polling place, and there was a sign on the polling place, you know, affixed to the door, which essentially said that if any, in more vulgar language, that if any black person voted, it would be the last thing that they ever did. Maceo thought, you know, I fought fascists, I got this. And he went and he voted. He was the only person in Taylor County, Georgia, only person of color in Taylor County, Georgia, to cast a ballot that day. You know, a few days later, a firing squad of white men showed up at his home and assassinated him. So, you know, what we talk about, the need for the Voting Rights Act, we talk mm-hmm. about, you know, not just the legislation that, you know, made poll taxes illegal or literacy tests, but, you know, the kind of federal enforcement that, you know, we even may be having to look at today to keep voters safe from intimidation, you know, and God forbid, violence at the polling places.
We're talking about the documentary All In, The Fight for Democracy on Amazon Prime. My guests are Liz Garbus and Lisa Cortez. They directed the film. So we really get to see the impact that the Voting Rights had on when it was passed in 1965. I want to play another clip from your film explaining how quickly Mississippi changed. Let's take a listen.
Days after the Voting Rights Act was passed, there were federal officials in the South registering African Americans to vote for the first time in counties where black people hadn't been able to register for decades. This was truly revolutionary.
By 1967, 2 years after the Voting Rights Act, almost 60% of black adults in Mississippi registered to vote. Game changer.
Lisa, how did that change who was elected?
Well, we start to see the officials that are truly reflective of the communities that mm-hmm. they come from. You know, it brings us in Texas to Barbara Jordan, mm-hmm. Andrew Young, and the expansion of the access to the franchise truly becomes a lockstep with the various communities who had been denied the access previously.
Yeah, I'm sort of walking through the decades. So that's the 60s. I want to get to the 70s next. We, you know, I think when people think about the Voting Rights Act and voter intimidation, immediately their minds goes to southern states. But when President Gerald Ford signed the extension of the Voting Rights Act in 1975, Arizona was added to the states affected by the law. Liz, what was going on in Arizona that it had to be put under supervision?
Yeah, in Arizona, which, you know, today sees some really great voting laws, actually, the same kind of tactics that were being used against black Americans in the South were being used against, like, Latinx people in Arizona and indigenous people as well. They had something called Operation Eagle Eye, for instance, which Rehnquist, former, the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, oversaw, which essentially went around to polling places and administered literacy tests, asking folks to recite the Constitution before they could have access to the ballot box. I would fail that test, I think. So what we saw were the same tactics being used. And, you know, in many of the northern states, too, you know, while they weren't covered in the 70s, and I know you're going by decades, But, you know, we have problems all over the country, and the Voting Rights Act then became, you know, sort of applied to states where you could prove a systemic disenfranchisement of minority groups.
When did the issue about voter protection break down along party lines? When did that first start to bubble up?
Well, I think it's the election of Barack Obama that really brings things to the forefront. Mm-hmm. And in 2013, there is the Supreme Court decision in Shelby County v. Holder, which basically dismantles the preclearance provisions that had been put in place by the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And it's actually in, you know, I think we're all devastated by the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And, you know, she offered a very interesting dissent. And she said, you know, throwing out preclearance is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. And I think what we see in Shelby County v. Holder in 2013 is this systematic dismantling of all of the progress that had been made since 1965 along partisan lines. And, you know, it's a great tragic moment.
I have to tell you, this is one of those moments that gives you the chills. I was watching your documentary on Friday night, and on that part about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the alert came on my phone.
No.
I swear on a Bible. It was just, it was one of those moments when the hair on my arms just went up. Let's take a listen.
Oh, that's
to
a lot.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip from State of Abrams, actually, talking about the impact of Shelby v. Holder. This is from All In, the Fight for Democracy.
And in the United States, the right to vote is the only right you can lose for not using it. You can decide not to go hunting on a Saturday and you don't lose your Second Amendment rights, but in 9 states, it is the law of the land that you can lose your right to vote simply for not using it. After the Shelby decision, we saw over 1,600 precincts close in the states that were once covered by the Voting Rights Act. And when you shut down a polling place where someone can go a mile to vote and suddenly they have to go 10 miles and they don't have a car, they will not vote.
Liz, when did voting roll purges, this idea of just getting people off the rolls, start to expand into other parts of the country?
You know, I don't know the date, but what happened after the Shelby decision that you guys were just talking about in 2013 was that, you know, all these voting laws, which could disproportionately affect certain groups like poor people who might move a lot, right? There were all these new tactics to keep people from having their voice counted at the ballot box. So, for instance, in Ohio, they started something, you know, that's, you know, sort of in a slang way referred to as the postcard trick, in which, you know, you might receive a postcard at your mailing address and it looks like junk mail. But if you don't return it, they say, oh, they don't live there anymore. They must not be a valid voter, or they've died, and therefore we purge them from the roll. Now, this happens, yes, and voters, you know, states need to keep their voting rolls clean, but there are certainly better ways to do this than just knocking people off the rolls because they haven't responded to a postcard. This is why when everybody talks today about, you know, making a voting plan, we always implore them, or, you know, voting rights advocates always implore them to check your registration, even if you're sure you're registered, because there are so many tactics that are used to knock people off the rolls without their awareness.
Lisa, you also tell the story of the fight to restore voting rights to people with felony convictions in Florida. This story has been in the news a lot lately because most recently the ballot initiative restored the voting rights, but then in July the Supreme Court ruled that those felony convictions only after people had paid court fees and fines. And then this morning, it was reported Mike Bloomberg has raised $16 million over the last week to help about 32,000 convicted felons pay those fees. Lisa, someone who's been steeped in this, how significant is that, the Bloomberg announcement?
Well, it's truly a game changer. And you know, the work of Desmond Meade and the Florida Rights Restoration mm-hmm. Coalition, you know, they brought it to the people, and the people had determined that the people of Florida, that they wanted these rights to be returned to returning citizens. And of course, there's been this battle back and forth. I see a corrective of, you know, the 1868 felony laws, which, you know, back then took away the right to vote for any returning citizens. And so it is corrective to this historical ill, and it is in keeping with the people's will that everyone be able to engage who is eligible and has served their time.
And as we mentioned at the top of the interview, Stacey Abrams is producing this project with you folks, came to you guys, and she is featured. What happened to her is featured prominently as a modern example of what happens when there's voter suppression, and I'll just use the word shenanigans to be polite. And we've covered that a lot. We've had Stacey on the show. So I wanted to ask the both of you, from her experience, what is a moment that stands out to you about her experience running for governor and what happened at the polls and around the election that year? Liz, why don't you go first?
Well, you know, one of the things when I heard Stacey speak once before I was working on this film, she told a story of her own experience going to vote. She was a well-known person. She was the Democratic candidate for governor in 2018. And, you know, they wanted to call attention to the fact that Georgia allows early voting. So she went to vote early. Of course, there were a couple cameras trailing behind her. And she shows up and the nice poll worker tells her, you know, "I'm sorry, Miss Abrams, but it says here that you've already voted absentee." And Stacey's reaction says, "Well, I'm quite sure, you know, I've never voted absentee. I always vote in person. And can you check that again?" And the poll worker said, "You know, I'm so sorry, Ms. Abrams. You know, it says here that you've already voted. I can't let you vote." And, you know, Stacey, you know, very politely leans over and says, "May I speak to your supervisor?" You know, meanwhile, cameras are trailing behind her. And, of course, it gets sorted out, right? They double check, they see the mistake, et cetera. But what happens when you don't have cameras trailing you? What happens when you don't have the sense of empowerment in order to question that official or ask for a supervisor? How many hundreds of people are counted out? And, you know, it's not just an issue of like fairness and what's fair. It's about, you know, democracy. It's about our representatives representing our communities. If we're not counted, then our needs and our communities are not brought to the table in the halls of government. It means that, you know, for instance, places can go for months and months and months without clean water if the politician from that district doesn't need to count on their mm-hmm. votes because they have so successfully either gerrymandered or found other shenanigans to keep those folks from having a voice in government. So it's really not just about like, oh, what's fair or this bureaucratic thing. It's about having a government that truly represents the people. And when people say, "Oh, we're a republic, we're not a democracy," we are a democratic republic in which the people elect representatives to represent their community's needs.
Lisa, your final words?
Well, I think when you look at the story of Stacey Abrams in 2018, what always, you know, people are saying like, well, where is the hope in the story? And the hope is in resilience. The hope is in Stacey telling us, you know what, I set Shiva, and then like the phoenix, I rose. And and she started Fear Fight. And the work that Fear Fight is doing to make certain that people's voters' voices are represented is remarkable, that she has worked with us to create a story that is making voter suppression part of everyday conversations that people are having. There is great progress and hope in this movement and this mobilization.
The name of the film is All In, The Fight for Democracy. It's on Amazon. There are two watch parties today on National Voter Registration Day. One is at Twitch starting at 2 p.m. Eastern. And then Stacey Abrams will be hosting one on Twitter at 7 p.m. tonight Eastern. Liz and Lisa, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks for making this film.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Allison.